Well, this morning, Jim Peterson and I primarily would like to, and with a couple others helping, would like to give you a little overview and some understanding of the scope of our ministries worldwide. First, I need to just say a little word of how we're organized. We don't spend a lot of time on structure, but we started many years ago as an American agency with some overseas branches. And we have deliberately developed into an international partnership of independent organizations that we call our global society. Adam, okay, can you hold that one off for just a little bit? Keep it up there. Just turn the machine off for a second. And I'd like to just talk a little bit about it before I give you a few of the statistics. What really binds us together in this global society is not a structure, nor is it a set of policies, but instead, we're united by a single vision, and it is a single vision, shared values, like Terry shared yesterday, there are certain values and deep relationships. Now, without a question, the largest member of our partnership and the oldest is the United States Navigators. And frankly, our partnership worldwide, especially when we think of missions and outreach, is extremely dependent on the U.S., providing about half of our staff worldwide, about two-thirds of our financing, and probably two-thirds of our cross-cultural missionaries as we launch out into the world. Now, in working with globally, I have the privilege of working with three vice presidents, and I'd like to just introduce them to you. Paul and Phyllis Stanley, would you stand? Paul and Phyllis are right back there. And Donald and Jeannie McGilchrist, where are you folks? Okay. And then Jim and Marge Peterson. Now, Jim's here. Is Marge here this morning? Oh, she knows what it's like to listen to you. Is that it? Oh, okay. All right. She said, I heard this before. But God has brought us together as a team, and we call this our international executive team. And we've given you a photograph. Can be used for a number of things. It can be used for darts. It can be used for whatever. We'd love you to use it as a refrigerator deal or a something in your Bible, and to pray for us, if you would, please. Now, as an IET, or an international executive team, we have four basic commitments. We think our job is this. We need to make sure that we are constantly strengthening our vision and our values. It's not managing, but our vision and values. Secondly, we need to empower and mentor our leaders. Like the U.S., this is the key to our future. If we do not raise up a generation of leadership following us, we will have failed. I mean, that's an essence of the Navigators, and we'll talk about that. Then to keep our focus on the third generation, we are multipliers, we are not adders in this business. And finally, to press us toward the frontiers and the edges of the world. I'd like the daisy, I call it my daisy wheel. This is a little bit of what we look like worldwide. And now we can do the lights down a little bit. We have an international executive team, and we're divided into regions. The African, the Asian, two Asians, the frontiers and the established country, the Central Europe, the Commonwealth, Eurasia, the American, Middle East, Western Europe, and so forth. No, Latin American, that is, and the USA. And that forms our regional team around the world. Our next planning conference with this group is going to be in May in Budapest. So we would appreciate your putting that on your calendar for some prayer. And under God's hand, we're really growing. And so with the next slide, I'd like to just give you a thumbnail. The thumbnail that we have, and it's on one of the documents you have in your that was on the chair with you. We have approximately 3,600 staff. That says 35, but we've actually gone up in the last bit of time. We're representing 50 nationalities. We're ministering amongst 135 peoples in 96 countries and doing that in 127 languages. I speak one poorly. But most of our staff speak three or four languages, those who are international. And we have just over 1,000 cross-cultural missionary staff. And we've entered in just in 1995, Mali, the Sudan, Bangladesh, Iceland, and Kyrgyzstan. Now, to give you a taste of this work, and that's what I'd like to be, like a good cup of coffee, Jim Peterson is going to come and give us a taste of one major thing that we're trying to do worldwide. Jim spent 23 years in Latin America and is our Brazilian and Latin director, and then has been in our team together, and we've labored together for, what are you laughing at?
A good cup of coffee.
A good cup of coffee, okay. Whenever they start laughing, I know I've either made a mistake or something. Like Mary, you guys are as bad as she is next to me there.
We're not as bad as she is.
No! You're going to have to face her in just a minute. Well, listen, Jim, come and you with some others take us through a little journey.
Okay, well, most of what I'm going to be telling you here this morning, you will never see in print, and the reason is because of the confidential nature of the material. In fact, I've never told what I'm going to be telling you this morning in public, because it is so confidential. Even my wife doesn't know, Jerry, what I'm going to talk about here this morning.
So you didn't let her come?
I didn't let her come. I don't want her to know these things. First of all, what is our ministry really all about? Let's get a slide up there. There we go. The heritage video that you saw the first night kind of laid the foundation. But wherever we go, whether it's the U.S. or whether it's the villages of India, we are thinking certain things. We are thinking of going to the lost. We're thinking of discipling the saved, we're thinking of spiritual generations, and laying foundations of godly leaders. And so we're grassroots people. We think long-term. And the effect of this, we've had 63 years of history, and the effect of this is that most of you know what compounding interest is. After 63 years of compounding interest in laborers, we find ourselves today with just an army of people around the world who are next door to some of the most difficult spots on earth. And this is a very sobering thing, because those of us who are in leadership today have a responsibility to be faithful to this trust that we've been given. And we need to be very careful to make sure that when we're gone, there are other people who share that same sense of responsibility and commitment to this trust. And so, just in this past year, I've connected with a number of people, and these people have one thing in common, and that is that they're on their way to someplace next door. For example, this fellow right here, Tunko, he's an engineer, architect, and he's on his way. He's a Nigerian. He's on his way to Niger, which is a neighboring country. Later on, I'll be talking actually about these three guys, Musa Yashin, who's also Nigerian, and this is Nuhu. I'll be telling a story about Nuhu, and I'll be telling a story about Ishako. Just keep those faces in your mind if you can, and we'll come back and talk about them. Another person that I was together with several times this year is Joe Sheremy. Joe is a Ghanaian. He was a high official in the Ghanaian government, spent 6 years in prison, met Christ there, and is now opening up our work in Burkina Faso, which is a neighboring country to Ghana. Then in March, I was in, or August, I was in Malaysia and was with this couple. This is Chi Ho and his family. And they're on their way into Bangladesh, which is a ways up the peninsula. But they are opening up a ministry together with six other people in Bangladesh. Now, Bangladesh, if you know anything about it, it's one of the most difficult spots on earth, totally Muslim. And to get in and to operate there, they're opening up a college. And so right now, in January, They are in the process of establishing this college and beginning to minister in Bangladesh. The next person, Gilbert. That's Gilbert on the left. This guy over here is our friend Bob Vedano, who is going to be speaking in a minute. But this guy is from Iraq, and we met him in Egypt, and this was just in November. And he's on his way. He's preparing to go to Iraq as a pastor. And I'll explain a little bit more about that later. But next July, he will be in Iraq. Then the next picture, you have Arvi Klakenes, who is a Norwegian. And he's been commuting into Tatarstan. And he's got his Tatar here. This is Takir. And so... he's been going into Tatarstan ministering, and he, you know, has his right-hand man here, and has, you know, several others. But again, here are people who are moving into some of the difficult spots on earth from some unlikely position, like you'd think Norway to Tatarstan, not necessarily an easy connection, but there they are, they're doing it. And finally, another example of the same thing, Karam. He was at our meeting in Bangkok. I'll tell you about that in a little while. We had 50% of the evangelical pastors in Iraq at our conference in Bangkok in end of November, December. That's it right there, this one guy. Saddam Hussein likes to give the impression that he is kind of in favor, you know, he's a liberal man and so on like that. And so he has allowed five evangelical churches to exist in Iraq. Some of them have been without pastors for as long as 13 years. This guy is one of them. They live with a sword over their heads. But what they say is, hey, it's easy to share the gospel in Iraq because there's people are just so desperate. They're all Muslim and it's very tight. It's against the law to do it. But you can get away with it because life is so desperate there. And so here's a man who is doing that in Iraq. And so we sweat. What I'm saying is that the most difficult spots on earth are next door to these labors that are being raised up, the compounded interest of 63 years of investment. The question is, where do you get people like this? You know, where do they come from? Well, they do not come by accident. What you see in every case here is that these people are the product of several generations. A navigator is sent to a country. He reaches somebody who turns around and reaches somebody else, who turns around and reaches somebody else, and that somebody else has a heart for the nations and ends up going to one of these places. And so, one example is there's an American that went to Germany and connected with a rather exotic scientist-type guy named Herman Jansen. And Herman Jansen decided that he wanted to go to Thailand to minister. And so he went to Thailand, got a job teaching in the Asia Institute of Technology, AIT. There he met a guy named Ong Mint, who was going to study medicine until he lost an arm in a car accident, became an engineer instead. And then he went back to his home country, Burma, and is now up in the villages of Burma preaching the gospel, going from village to village. And so the point is that what we're finding, what is dawning on us, is that we are positioned everywhere in the world. And I find myself wondering, has there ever been a time in the history of missions where we have people of stature, people who have had a decade of investment made in them, positioned so that right next door to them, where they can go, they have the language, they have the race, they have the preparation, they can go and be message bearers. And that's the thing that we find ourselves with today. And so we take that as sort of a holy trust that God has given us. And, well, we're going to have to get on with it and make sure that we fulfill it. So, you know, what does this mean? What's involved in our, as the leaders of the work, being faithful to this trust? Well, put the slide up on the major religions. This is what we're really up against. The challenge of taking the gospel to the major religions has gradually come into focus for us over the past decade. You've got 2/3 of the world's population there. You can read the numbers. And the distressing fact is that in the modern missionary movement, we really haven't done a good job of moving the gospel into these religions. And the reason is because many of us as missionaries, we have not been able to sort out our culture from our message. And because we haven't, we bring our culture along with our message, and it's a contaminated gospel, and so the people who respond to it, they buy into the American way of life and Jesus. But this part of the message that they receive that isn't just Jesus makes them peculiar in the eyes of the people that are around them. And as a result, they're marginalized within their own society. They say, hey, you aren't really Burmese anymore, or you aren't really Chinese anymore. You've gone Western on us. And so there are unnecessary changes that are imposed on people as they come to Christ. And this over and over again around the world, the gospel has been bogged down because the people who become believers become unnecessarily odd in the eyes of the people that surround them. Now, we're not alone in this discovery. What we're finding is that many mission agencies are awakening to this dilemma and to this challenge. I've asked Bob to give us an illustration of what I'm talking about. Bob?
Do we have a picture of Chu and Kenneth?
Yeah.
No, we don't. Yeah. Okay. Just to give you an illustration of what we're saying here, on your right is Chu and her husband, Kenneth. Chu came to Christ at Oregon State University. She's from Buddhist background. And that's just exciting. She has returned to Thailand, has her PhD, and she's responsible for a foundation. She leads a foundation that helps rural education, that helps families to be able to not send their children into Bangkok and sell them into prostitution. And so that is her, this is what this foundation is about. After she came to Christ at Oregon State, she came to Glen Eyrie for our Leadership Development Institute. Having ministered to Muslim, I thought, what a phenomenon she is. Here is a Buddhist who's come to Christ, going back to her country. And I thought, you know, the most key thing will be that she has a husband who also is Buddhist background and has come to Christ. And we prayed. This was 10 years ago. I went to Thailand for a conference Jim will tell you about. And Chu and Kanat met me at the airport. He is a gift of God. Buddhist background, has come to Christ. And she was part of the process of his coming to Christ. So, man, what a setup. I was so excited about this. Here are two people ready to go and are actually planted within their country. We had lunch together. They began telling me about just life in Bangkok. Unbelievable. As you many have been there. Huge city. They spend hours each week in traffic, just going to work and coming back. And to meet me at the airport, both of them had to take a day off work. They just couldn't do it any other way. They maintain life on Saturday. They just get life together. And then they began to tell me they spend Sunday at church. And they don't have much time for their family and friends, they began to talk about. Kenneth began to tell me they both have great networks of Buddhist friends, but just not much time with them. And Kenneth was kind of saying, you know, I tell my friends now I don't drink. Great. And I don't play golf on Sunday anymore. And the only one possible day they can connect with a number of their friends, and their past is on Sunday. And as we talked, and we continued to talk, I asked them, now, what is all this saying to your friends about the gospel? And as we talked, we began to see, and they began to see, that their lives have moved into a tiny cul-de-sac where the gospel is totally being cut off from their friends. And the cul-de-sac is so small that if they want to go to another church, they have to get permission from the pastor to be able to do that, that the other pastor would let them in. And then the guy that helped Kenneth and followed him up and kind of helping both of them, boy, he said, if I related to my Buddhist friends on a Sunday and went out on the golf course with my buddies, I'd get real grief. And so I just realized they're totally being cut off. Chu had written me a letter before I got there, and she was having real problems with American missionaries. And they're always right. And so the little cul-de-sacs have a number of American missionaries that are still continuing to run the situation. And so as talking about marginalized, I said, you know, you need to meet a friend. And I introduced him to John Ridgway. John leads our work in the Rice Bowl. But what's interesting, John also tutored the Crown Prince of Thailand and lived in the palace with the king and the queen. And he was there, so we introduced them, and Kanat and Chu began to spend hours with him in the evenings after the meeting on Saturday nights. We had two Saturday nights, and they would come over, and we would say, suck his blood, just hours and hours. And as I was leaving, Chu and Kanat says, this time has been like revival. We are seeing we need to connect, and we have not been connecting with our friends.
Thanks, Bob. That really illustrates what we're up against. And what it means is that we have to rethink missions and how we approach missions so that people like this can actually move forward into their society with the gospel, become message bearers, rather than live in isolation. And so this is something that's just dawning on us. And so we have to... We're just having to go after that. And this is what we're doing. We are tackling this issue. And one illustration of it is, about 3 years ago now, it was a July day, maybe 3.5 years ago, that the four of us in the IET were sitting and we're talking about the Middle East. And, we were talking about how difficult it is in the Middle East and how little space people have to be able to share Christ. The margin for error is just about zero. Like this one guy who's in Sudan got arrested because his wife was on the street with a dress that didn't cover her ankles. And so he was called in at 7 o'clock in the morning and waited until 5 o'clock at night to finally begin his interrogation. And then about 1 o'clock in the morning, they put him out on the street, totally terrified and so on. But those kinds of things happen all the time when you're working in the Arab Muslim countries or the Muslim countries of any kind, for that matter. And so we talked about the fact that there are a number of people in the Arab Muslim world that are out there, they've been there for a decade, don't have much to show for their efforts because the space isn't there, and they're just making mistakes and so on. And so then our discussion expanded. Why don't we go on to the next slide? Our discussion expanded to the rest of the Muslim world. That's the famous 1040 window, talking about the latitude and longitude lines and so on. It's where this two-thirds of the world population that we talked about, most of it is right there in that window. There are 64 countries there. We are in 34 of those 64 countries. But as we thought our way through the Muslim part of the 1040 window, and what you see in green there is predominantly Muslim, but it stretches across Northern Africa or North Africa, the black Northern Africa,
and then, of course, the Middle East, and on through into Pakistan, and down into India, Bangladesh, and then down into the into Indonesia, Malaysia, and so on. And that's the predominant center. Oh, and then of course the old Turkish Empire up here, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, so on. And that's the predominantly Muslim world. And we calculated that we had between 30 and 40 people out there, kind of at the end of the line, receiving almost no help. They just kind of migrated in there as a part of this compounding interest thing that's going on. And so we said, we need to do something about that. And my three brothers decided, yes, that's a wonderful opportunity. Jim, it looks like it has your name on it. And I said, thank you. I was really looking for something to do. And so, off we went. And I went and spent a few nights awake. Well, what are we going to do about this? How are we going to serve these people that are scattered all over the place? Came up with a team of five men. Four of us are right here in town, and the other one is living now in Singapore. The fellow that Bob just mentioned, who was a tutor of the Crown Prince, this is John Ridgway. John spent 18 years in India. He and I worked together very closely for a number of those years, working at reaching the Hindu in India. And then Nabil Jabour, who is Lebanese, born in Syria, spent, 15 years in Egypt, and then got kicked out. And then there's Neil Grinheim, who spent 15 years working among the Sundanese in Indonesia, and saw God really blessed there. And then Bob Vedano, who spent 20-some years living in the Middle East, overseeing our work in the Middle East. And so we got together, and we came up with a very simple strategy, just a two-stage strategy. One, let's get out there and see what's going on. And so over the years, we visited most of those places that you see on the map. And we were looking for three things. First of all, where is there is there space where we can work in these places? And sometimes we thought, yeah, there would be, but there wasn't. Sometimes we thought, hey, this place would have no space at all to work, but there was. And so there were some surprises. We were also looking for people. Who is there who is looking for help that would respond to the kind of thing that we would have to offer? We expected to find 30, 40. We found more like 300-400 people scattered across there who are ready to be equipped. And then another thing that we found was that people were making just very simple, obvious mistakes in what they were doing. And those mistakes often were costing them years of effort. And, you know, strangely enough, that was encouraging. Because if you see things that are happening and see that there's some things that are going wrong and you can fix it, help people fix it, well, then they can go on and see fruit. And so some of the mistakes, for example, in this one city, Surabaya, which is in western Indonesia, very unusual town. In the last 5 years, about 500 industries have come into the city, and they have recruited people from the surrounding villages and towns, young people between the ages of 18 and 25, to come in to work these factories. And these people receive $1.50 a day payment, salary. Now that's enough to provide for one room that has no plumbing, and it's enough to feed them if you don't eat very much. And so here they are, they're putting in a full day of work, then there's a certain area of the city where all this is going on. And then at about 6 o'clock, when the whistle blows, it's like a campus. You've got these thousands of people thronging the streets, heading back to their houses. They have no money for entertainment or anything else, and so they spend the whole evening hanging out. It's a paradise for navigators. Now, one glitch is there's a mosque every 100 meters. No exaggeration. I mean, they have a mosque. Their mosques are all over the place. Well, the Navs have been in Indonesia for many years, And so a number of our Indonesians who were reached for Christ, for instance, in Bandung in the university ministry, have gone in there, maybe 20, 30 of them, have gone into this city of Surabaya and set out to reach these people. And so I was sitting with these 20, 30 and asking, how's it going? And he says, well, we really haven't seen any fruit yet. And I says, well, tell me what you're doing. Well, we get to know these people. We make friends. And then what happens? Well, then when we feel like the friendship can stand it, why, we share the gospel. And I said, well, then what happens? And they said, well, they always say, what's mine is mine, is what's yours is yours. It's their way of saying, I'm a Muslim, you're a Christian, let's leave it that way. And then I said, well, then what do you do? Well, then we just go on to somebody else. And I thought, oh, man, you're just getting started. That's the starting point of evangelism, not the ending point. And so their notion of evangelism, which is something that came off of a campus, being applied to a Muslim situation, was destroying years of effort that they were investing. And so that's something you can help them with. That's something that can be fixed. No big deal. Another illustration in Isha, it was Nuhu. You had these four guys from Nigeria up there. The second from the left, Nuhu. He went in. He was asked by the government to go into his hometown and do a survey, just a population survey. And so he went in. Guy's a converted Muslim. And so he went back to his home village, which is all Muslim. There's one Christian in the town. This one Christian was an evangelist, a pastor. And he'd been there for 3 years and had not seen any fruit. Well, Nuhu brought the Jesus film with him. Now, when he brought the Jesus film, he went in and the first mistake he made, he stayed where? With the pastor. And so it was kind of like, going to the leper colony, to identify with this pastor. Well, then the two of them set up the screen and everything else and showed the Jesus film. They didn't know whether they're going to get stoned to death or whether he's going to be accepted. But they showed the film. People liked it. And so the next night, the whole village wanted to see it. 3,000 people saw the Jesus film. Afterwards, one guy came up and he said, well, I would like to, he told Nuhu and the pastor, he says, well, I'd like to become a Christian. Well, the pastor said, attention, everybody, this person here wants to become a Christian. And here's the future father-in-law going into a rage and the rest of the village, looking at this. And Nuhu said, this guy came up to him and says, well, look, he says, I'd rather become a Christian at some other time in some other village. Well, see, now that's a mistake that you can avoid. And so we were seeing these kinds of things happen as we got around and visited. Yeah, this is Nuhu right here. Thank you. He just got away from me. We're playing cat and mouse here. So anyway, those are the kinds of things, and there are all kinds of stories about how people would just get into situations that had all the potential of being fruitful, and then they'd make a mistake that would compromise what they were trying to do. And so then the next stage of our strategy is to begin to network these people who are out there, the practitioners, the people that are on the front lines, begin to network those people together so they can learn from each other. Because what happens is one person has one piece of it, another person has another piece of it, and nobody has the whole deal. And so if we can get those people to begin to talk with each other and learn from each other, then we will really make progress. And so we had several regional networks or think tanks is what we call them, going on. We had one in Nigeria, another one in Malaysia. But the idea is to bring these people together just to work on the issues that stand between them and reaching the Muslim world. The major one that we had was just the end of November and December last month, and we called it Bangkok 1 because we planned to have Bangkok 2 because we didn't cover our whole agenda. We met to discuss just one subject, one issue, and that is, what is the gospel for the Muslim? How do you communicate the gospel to the Muslim? How do you cut a path through the scriptures to Christ for the Muslim mind? And our basic approach was we had four case studies, each one presented by the person who founded that particular movement. The first one here is Stuart Robinson. He's an Australian. He and I corresponded for 20 years before we ever met. The original networker, some of you know him, Bob Glockner, met Stuart in Australia, and he already knew me. I was in Brazil. Stuart was on his way to Bangladesh, and we began to correspond. He couldn't just write out deliberately what he was doing, so he'd write me poetry. And he would try to tell me in poems what was really going on. I never did catch on to a lot of it. We met for the first time in Lausanne, too, which was in Manila, but discovered that this guy God has used him to establish and begin a movement of people coming to Christ in Bangladesh, about 5,000 people, you know, starting out in a village. And so he was one of the presenters. So he took a whole day, presented his story. We came back, asked him questions and so on. The next presenter was Mazhar and Christine Maluhi. Mazhar is Syrian, and he got out of jail just in time to come to our meeting. And he worked in Tunisia. Then the next person that did a presentation was Samuel. And this is Samuel and Mazhar again. Get a good fix on Samuel's face here, because I'll tell you a story about him in a minute. And then Nabil Jabour is one of the five of us that lead this thing. He also participated in sharing the story of Egypt. And then Dave McCollum is the person who helped start to work together with Neil Grindheim among the Sundanese in Indonesia. And so we spent a day on each one of these case histories. And then we had one more person who was there, who represented, give the video rest. All right. Well, we give the video a rest. Let's call. We had another person from a very deprived part of the world who also participated. They call him Okies. It was Russ Tubner. And Russ was there. And yesterday I says, Russ, why don't you just tell people what you saw that Bangkok thing to be all about? So you're on, Russ.
A deprived part of the world? I have never been introduced like that. Leave it to Jim. How many of you have been to Stillwater, Oklahoma? Now, how many of you agree? How many of you agree with Jim's assessment that it's a deprived part of the world? Oh, come on! Okay, we got a guy here who supports the OU Sooners. Who else we got here? Well, if I had to put a title on what this, what was it, a week plus, was all about, or if I had to write a paper about it, I would say it, I would entitle it My Week with the Radical Fringe, the Radical Fringe of Christian Missions. I don't think I had ever had the opportunity to rub shoulders, and it was really quite a privilege just to hang out. I was probably one of maybe only two people who were really outside the context that most of these people lived and worked in. It may come as a surprise, there is not a large Muslim community in Stillwater, Oklahoma. I obviously could not even claim to even exist within the same context, much less have experienced the same things that these other men and women have experienced. But the thing that the conference really did focus on, that Jim alluded to, was really this idea of the purity of the gospel. Now, the more I thought about that prior to going, when Jim first told me about this conference earlier in 95, and the more I although I didn't tell a lot of people about what I was going to be doing or going to. But every time I mention this phrase, the purity of the gospel, both in my own mind as I heard it, and I could see it almost on the faces of the people that I might talk to, there are kind of two reactions. The first reaction was, yeah, that's important. And then the second reaction is kind of like, but what's the big deal? So what's so difficult about that? Because from our perspective as believers in America, we don't necessarily view this as rocket science. Now that's our mistake, by the way. that's telling in and of itself. But we don't view this as nearly as much of an issue as it obviously is. And after spending 7 to 10 days with these other individuals, I came away convinced that, in fact, I told them at the end that unbeknownst to them and even myself prior to coming, they were in fact blazing a trail for those of us who would also have to grapple with these issues in our own culture and within our own context. The more I listened to people talk about the issue of the purity of the gospel, there seemed to be two dimensions of this. One is the issue of just the way that we might present the gospel. But the other issue is how we portray the gospel. And the sad thing is, and we heard many stories to this effect, that our portrayal of the gospel undermined our presentation of the gospel. So our words, our presentation, our facts, even the path that we might cut through the scriptures would be very accurate and lead us from point A to point B. But quite often, what happened after that 1 or 2 hour conversation, our portrayal of the gospel, becomes that which cuts ourselves off at the knees in our ability to demonstrate the reality of the gospel in our own life. So really, Jim asked me to just think about what did I come away with, and I came away with a couple of things. One was I came away with eyes that had been opened to how easy it is to confuse my presentation of the gospel through my portrayal of the gospel. I can create massive confusion. And the more I thought about that during the week, I had to look at myself and say, yes, I have confused the matter in many ways. The second thing I kind of came away with was that just in listening to various people talk about their experiences ministering amongst what is arguably the most difficult people in the world to reach with the gospel, I came away realizing that God is big enough to do this. There is hope that God can do this. But when I thought about what is the root of that hope, it came down to this one very thing. And that is that the darkness in another person's heart is never any greater than the darkness that he has overcome in my own heart and continues to overcome day by day. That very thing is the issue upon which we, even within our own context, can in fact minister with hope. The darkness that he has overcome in my own heart is, when I look at that honestly in the mirror, the darkness that I might find or observe in another person's heart is never any greater. Well, as a result of my week with the Radical Fringe, I came back and I guess I was feeling rather radical myself. And so I began to try to figure out what am I going to do about all this stuff. I got to go do something. And so I own a software company, and we just so happened to have a Christmas party coming up a couple of days, or actually a week afterwards. And I began to talk with my wife, and we began to try to figure out how can we portray the gospel. How can we communicate in a way to the employees and their spouses within my company what the gospel looks like? How can I take what I've learned in this context? And so we did a few things and ran a few experiments during that evening. And, who knows? Only time will tell as to their effectiveness or to whether or not they did, in fact, create a more accurate portrayal of the gospel. But it had an immediate benefit, an immediate impact on me, and I can honestly say I think I'll be marked by those 10 days with the Radical Fringe for quite some time.
It was great to have Russ along. One of the reasons we had him was being in the computer business. We were hoping that perhaps we can begin to network some of these people that are scattered across this whole part of the world and be able to communicate with them via email or whatever. And we're still working on that. I don't think it's very hopeful, but we're going to see what we can do about that. But Russ made another point that I think is really important, and that is that the things we learn on what he calls the radical fringe, which I just feel is, you know, dead center conservatism, has application in the more normal environment. And the things we learn out there, we bring them back home, and boy, they really do make a difference. They really can empower. I have four lessons that I'd like to pass on to you very quickly that we learned as we were with these, it went through these four case studies. There's an article in this worldwide that's in the back of your notebook on these 4 points, and so you can check them there. But what was really interesting was that from these four case histories, one given by an Australian Baptist, another one given by a guy from Frontiers Mission, two from the Navigators, what was really interesting was that all of them had certain things in common. And the first thing that they all had in common, in every case, there was a clear vision of what they wanted to see happen, and they prayed that vision into reality. Jesus said, according to your faith, be it done unto you. And apparently that's about what you get. Whatever you believe God for, that's about what you're going to get, and you're not going to get much more. And that's a rather sobering thought. But one illustration of this was Stuart Robinson, who was sent by the Australian Baptists to Bangladesh, and he was supposed to run this missionary compound. He looked at the compound and said, hey, the only good this thing is doing is we're providing some employment for a few Bangladeshis. And so, in the midst of a chorus of protests, he shut the compound down and moved to an insignificant town, someplace else in Bangladesh, and he spent the next 2 years praying. He had a vision. He said, God, if there is not a movement of people with the gospel, then my work here will amount to nothing. He spent 2 years praying. Then he began to see the response. And so the first step that always has to happen is that there needs to be a vision, and we need to claim that vision through prayer, because it's the work of God that does it. The second lesson is that I guess we're still hot, huh? Second lesson is that they live the message. The receiver must see the same gospel he's hearing, because you'll inevitably think, if I accept this gospel, I must become like the messenger. I remember when we were working in Brazil, we were surprised by the amount of scrutiny we were going through by the people that we were reaching, and discovered that even the brand of toothpaste we used, they thought, well, that's what Christians use. And so they go buy the same brand of toothpaste. And so if you just, there is no thing that's neutral about your image as you are sharing Christ. The receiver does not distinguish between what's gospel and what's the Christian way of life. You have to just be very careful to be coherent in every area. The third point is that all of these people had learned to avoid isolating a seeker from his family and friends. And they were careful to, and what they would do is they would set out to meet the family and friends and build trust with them. Now, in a lot of the Middle East, especially the Arab Middle East, the mentality among the Christians is, if a person comes to Christ, one of the first things we need to do is get him a plane ticket to Detroit, because he's going to be dead meat if we leave him in Egypt or wherever. And a lot of that goes on. In fact, I was approached while I was there to help raise money to send new converts to the USA. But there's no future to that. And so there's got to be a way to get people to come to Christ and stay there after they've come to Christ. Now, and one illustration of that, and a lot of this is so unnecessary, is Ishako, this guy that was on the end here. I told you, remember his face? I'm sure you do. He became a believer. He's a classy guy. He's of the Hausa tribe and of royal blood. He was in line to be one of the emir or the king of the Hausa tribe there in northern Nigeria. And so he came to Christ and he was being baptized. And there he was in the water. He was telling the story. There he was in the water. And the pastor was standing with him. And he says, now, when you come out of the water, we want to hear your Christian name. And he thought, oh man, that was the first he heard of it, you know, my Christian name. So there he is in the water. The only thing he can think about is, my name, my name, my name. And he came out and the pastor says, what's your name? And he says, Isaac. And which is the English translation of Ishako. And he said, I went into the water, a Hausa. I came out an Englishman. And he named two of his daughters English names. And their grandmother cannot pronounce their names. And so, by making unnecessary changes, he destroyed his access to his own family and his own people. And so this business of being careful to not isolate the seeker, the person that's responding, from his family and network, the whole future depends on that, because they either become a blockade or they become a roadway to the people that you want to reach. And the fourth thing that we learned was that in every case, these four people, Stuart Robinson, Mazar Maluhi, Samuel and Nabil, and Dave McCollum, they all figured out how to have an ongoing interaction in the scriptures with the people that we're seeking. Now, that's against all odds. And I hear this in every culture. You know, the Americans say, hey, Peterson, you can't get people to examine the Bible week after week because they're not interested. And you go over to Europe and it's worse. They say they discard the Bible as being totally irrelevant. You go to the Muslim world and it's even worse. They say, well, the Bible is viewed as being, it's been tampered with, and so there's no point to trying to do anything with it. Well, whatever the argument, you got to cut through it. And this is a skill that we're going to have to learn if we're going to reach the people in the world, is that we need to learn how to have Jesus come off the page as we explore the Bible together with those who don't believe, and it takes time. Now, another thing that came through that really was striking was the fear. I mean, I've been in several places this year where fear has just been bubbling under the surface. For instance, in Nigeria in May, this guy, Musa Yashin, the other guy over in the left-hand corner, the right-hand corner, he came to me and he says, well, what do I do with my fear? And I said, tell me about it. And he says, well, they threatened to come and burn our house down and hack me to pieces with a machete. He says, now that's scary. But he said, what I really can't handle is they say they're also going to hack my two daughters to pieces. What do I do with that? Well, then got over to Malaysia, meeting with people from China. And there was a guy that had just fled from China the day I got there. We landed in Kuala Lumpur the same day together. And he's an engineer, worked for Kempinski Hotel in China for 4 years, and had led a couple hundred Chinese to Christ. The secret police got on his case, began to film what he was doing, and on one day, they simultaneously, in three cities, arrested 18 people, eventually released 15, tortured a couple of them, and so there he was, feeling guilty for having fled. But in this group of about 50 people who were working in China, the fear just bubbled under the surface. The fellow that you saw over here, Samuel, working, he leads our work in Egypt. He has a little suitcase packed. And it's in his closet, and he has everything that he needs in it when the knock comes at the door at night and they take him off to prison. And their question there in Egypt, as we were together, the final question was, what do we do with our fear? And so I said, well, what does the Bible say about fear? So we looked at it. It's surprising what the Bible has to say about fear. It says a lot about fear. And some of what it says about fear is that it, you know, it's rather distressing because, you know, Jesus was, he ran a school of faith. And around the school of faith, you always have fear because the opposite of faith is fear. And so he said, why is it that you're so fearful? You know, the boat's half full of water and the wind is blowing. Why are you afraid? Where is your faith? And so he was always working away on their fear. And, you know, he was kind of flip about what's going to happen to us. He didn't say, you know, gosh, fellas, I'm sorry that I've got you into this because, boy, bad things are going to happen to you and it's going to hurt you. You're going to get, you know, head cut off and get crucified and stuff like that. He said, hey, don't worry about those that can kill your body and afterwards have nothing more they can do to you. Hey, getting your body killed, that's bad enough, isn't it? I mean, it's as bad as it can get. He says, no, there are worse things than that. Rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. So instead of being apologetic about what he's putting us into, he says, hey, don't worry about it. Don't be afraid. And he's trying to get us beyond the intranscendental existence that we live, time, space, possessions, and everything else. And he's getting us, trying to get us to think in terms of those things that are of true importance. And he says, you get past that, and you get past your fear. And so in Revelation, it says, they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb, the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death. And I realize that as we move into these sections, these parts of the world that I'm talking about, we are going to have some casualties. And we cannot feel badly about that. We have to accept that as being part of the deal. All of us deal with fear. And I found myself reflecting, okay, what about my fears? My daughter shared a verse with me. She's in Brazil right now and had to work her way through a lot of fears. And I think it sums up the reason why fear is such a tremendous enemy. It talks about Jesus. He said this is in Hebrews chapter 2, he shared in their humanity so that by his death he might destroy him who holds the power of death. That is the devil. So the devil holds the power of death. He can kill you. But don't worry about it. And free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. Now, probably most of us in this room can identify with that. We're kind of paralyzed by, you know, something bad can happen. And whether you're worried about having your children hacked to death with a machete, or having them get hit by a car, or being propositioned for drugs or something like that, fear is fear, and it will paralyze you. And a paralyzed person is a person that cannot be led by the Spirit of God. And so if Satan can get us to fear, he's done a number on us. He doesn't have to bother to kill us because we're just the walking dead if we are afraid. So this is the scenario that we are faced with today. And I would like to leave you with three prayer requests. The Apostle Paul, interesting, his number one prayer request in Ephesians 6:19 was, pray that I will have the courage to proclaim the gospel as I ought. And so for this army of people, and myself included, pray that we will have the courage to march ahead in the face of everything that would stand against us. And we would proclaim the gospel as we ought. That's number one. The second prayer request I want to leave you with is that we will be good stewards of this 63 years of heritage. That we will be faithful to these people. Many of them, they have the heart to go, the desire to go, but they do not have the know-how. They've grown up in a provincial situation, and they need the cross experiences of, you know, 63 years of learning by trial and error and teaching from the Lord and so on. And so we need to bring that to them. And so pray that we will be faithful stewards to this thing. The third thing I'd like to ask you to pray for, and Jerry will be talking more about this right now, and that is that for this army to march ahead, it needs leaders. And pray that God will, among these people, raise up leaders to carry us into this next phase of our calling. Jerry?
Thanks, Jim. That just zoomed in on one major thrust that we're doing, and most of us have been in certain situations like that. Paul Stanley, for many, many years, led our work in Eastern Europe, and all of the people they're working with lived in fear. Jim has shared several of those things. I've been on roads in Nigeria where we're stopped by police with AK-47s. I was picked up in a recent country because I stayed with one of our embassy personnel for a little while in an armored Cadillac, and then a few days, and with armed guards around his house, and a few days later they had an attack on the embassy there. You know, so it's a reality of where we go and what we do. But what becomes of this effort in the Muslim world and in other of the frontier situations, that is the Hindus, the Buddhists, the Chinese, and even the postmodern West, will be determined by the kind of leaders that we are and the kind of leaders that we develop for the next generation. And as Jim has clearly shared, God has entrusted us with a global army, which is this compounded interest of 60-some years of investment. So we in the IET, as well as Terry in the U.S. and his team, are painfully aware that the critical need is to raise up the next generation of leaders who will sustain the momentum in the global effort. And the developing of these leaders is amongst our highest priorities. We know exactly who they are. You've seen several of them in that part. We could show you a picture and identify the name and describe who is mentoring them and who is developing them around the world. They are getting prepared and positioned. And each of you has your own story about how you came around the Navigators and with this movement. I've been a part since 1955 when I was a student at the University of Washington. But a lot of what we've told you today, we have become aware of just in the last 2 to 3 years. And we, of course, had no idea what we were getting into. And there's always a question, at what cost? Now, many of you business people want to know that, and that's part of what we're going to do at this conference. Let me just say that this global work of the Navigators is in excess of $100 million per year. We are committed, that is our budget, and we are committed to lead that work through our international executive team at less than 1% of that. And for that team to function is about $979,000. We worked in the last couple of weeks and have identified that somewhere between 109 and 117,000 is where we fall short for this particular year. And so we will leave you with that as an idea. But you can see that this is a mustard seed ministry. We plant, water, nourish, and then bring it to fruition around the world. It's quiet, it's unobtrusive. We hope people don't even see it. But it's growing, and it is truly bearing fruit around the world. I'd like to just give you a few minutes to ask some questions. I hope you've learned something, as Russ did, from his time. So do you have some questions you'd like to ask Jim and me, Bob, any of us? And then we'll wind it up and go to coffee break. Stan?
Do you think any of that mentality, if we brought someone to Christ within the cults, should we leave them within the cults to minister to people within the cult?
It's not the cult, it's the culture in which they live. Would you say, Jim, why don't you respond to that?
Yeah, I'm talking about if you leave them in the Muslim context, should we leave them in the Mormon context?
Well, in the Muslim context, there's no separation between the religion, the culture, the government, the school system. It's one package. And so people have to become, often what we say is when we tell a person that they're Christian, is that we say you have to discard that whole package and become something else. And so it's not really the same as what we're talking about. But what I would say, you know, about the Mormon is, yeah, he goes to church and gets a dose of poison every week, and that's not going to do him any good. But what he needs to be careful of is he needs a body of people that will help him build his life around the truth. But just because his family and his parents and everybody else are Mormons does not mean that he should separate from them. He needs to keep the relationships going, the love bond, so that he continues to have access to them because, like in 1 Corinthians 7, says, how do you know what's going to happen? The fruit that will come if you stay connected.
There's a big difference also. The cult situation is a perversion of Christianity. That's not what we're talking about in these elements. They are not, this is something totally apart and different. And I think you approach those in a slightly different way. I mean, in Islam, you don't have a facade of Christianity, nor do you in Buddhism, nor do you in Shintoism and so forth, animism.
Yeah, the fact is, in these cultures, you have no place to go. See, what if I say, okay, Stan, you've become a Christian, now you got to stop being American. Well, what should I become? Well, I'm a Brazilian. You got to become Brazilian. So you do your best to become Brazilian. But that's really kind of what we're doing in this area in missions. Sam?
We have a client who's Hindu, a PhD, and very interesting. A few years ago when we had Doug Cole here, mm-hmm. he made a comment about it. It's not Christ that's the problem, it's Christianity. Remember the context of where it's coming from there. And I've been just testing that. And it's interesting, the conversations we talked about just about Christ.
Mm-hmm.
He asked me about my got around to talking about it. I said, I don't want to talk about religion. I don't want to get into it. But I want to talk about Christ. Very powerful.
Yes, very powerful.
Great dialogue.
Yeah.
Very encouraging.
Thanks, Sam. Harold?
Gary, I have a friend who's the CEO of World Arab Missions. And is there a way navigators can hook in, either on a consultative basis, not to reinvent the wheel, that there's some area that they've learned the lessons already, so that navigators don't have to relearn these hard lessons. And he's talked to me a lot about confidentiality, same thing that Jim did. But isn't there a way that this has been in existence so long, World Air Missions, that navigators can get help from that?
Right. He'll respond, but I want to point out two things. There are missions that have been in existence for a long time that have not discovered these principles, and then the many who have we're already connected with, and I don't know whether we are there or not, but Jim? Yeah, we have informal relationships with many other organizations. We avoid the formal relationships. For instance, the 22nd through the 24th, there's going to be a big consultation on Islam here in Glen Eyrie. We're not going to be there. Because the notes from that meeting will end up in Saudi Arabia, and we don't want to be in those notes.
Now, we're very cautious on some of the public things, and to be honest with you, we're taking some risks. We're crossing some of what people have practiced in long-term missions. Just recently, the Southern Baptists, I believe, have said we have got to rethink our entire mission program and are doing it, and we're in touch, I believe we are, with them in those areas and what we're doing and the way we do it. And we're in touch with Frontiers, and we're in touch with a number. We are not alone, nor would we ever want to communicate that we found the answer. What we have is a sacred trust of a network of people who are already there. They are not expatriate. And we are already nurturing. I mean, you did not see many white faces and all that stuff that Jim showed. I mean, those are names. They're real people. And by the way, they're leaders. They're not just someone who just came to Christ and we happened to get a snapshot of them as we went through so we could show the church at home. We've been nurturing them for years. Okay? Yes.
Is it
Jill?
Possible to get a help us the photographs of these people relative to the prayer ministry for us? So we need to see their faces.
Yes. There are. We won't identify. Well, Jim, can I put that with you and Bob?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, if you'll contact Jim and Bob, we don't want to do it wholesale, but those who would really want a prayer, we'll get you a photograph of them. We have some other strange faces in that photograph you already have, and you mean that ought to be enough.
Yeah,
but
yeah, those are really strange faces. But maybe what we could do is just have a sign-up sheet. Let's see if I have a clean piece of paper. Just put a sheet up there, and then put your name, and we'll, if you want some pictures of some of these people, we'll get them to you.
But take them to pray, okay? That's what we really want. The other thing, by the way, that worldwide that's in the back, if any of you want to get that, we publish it quarterly, but we don't recruit anybody to be on it. But if you'd like to get that worldwide, we'll be glad to send it to you if you'll leave us your address. Chris?
Jerry, the thing that Jim talked about people coming to Christ and then being asked to withdraw from their culture, in a sense, I think may trick us in this room into minimizing the more pertinent personal issue, which is what Russ brought up. And that is that we all do that same thing every day. And what he called portrayal, I guess he means the way we live out.
Yeah, the lifestyle.
The gospel,
right. By the way, if you examine the U.S. team, Terry and his leadership, and if you've been here over the period of the last several years, that's precisely what they're trying to do within the U.S. Terry, where are you? Yeah, isn't that right? You're trying to do that in the U.S., to teach people how to have a lifestyle that communicates. And many of the innovations that Terry and his team have made in the United States ministries have been to get us out of some of those patterns that we have been, that was preventing us from reaching many of the religious and the secular lost. And he mentioned that.
In fact, Jerry, I think probably one of the most difficult things, and that's why we have charted a course the next 3 years with Jerry and his team and with us and the national leadership team, is to take those lessons learned back in to some models here in our own country, because the fact is that it's just as true here, but it's so subtle that the grips of that are allowing an intellectual gospel without any incarnation or life or change. And people are being subtly deceived. And so we have got to break the back of that here in this country as well.
Yeah.
The very same thing that we're talking about globally and internationally is even more subtle and grippy.
And then the other thing is since the U.S. is still one of the primary sources of these people who go out, we want our ministries in the U.S. to produce people who think like that, who think of how do you cross those cultures, because then there's less that we need to do to prepare them when they go internationally. So, well, I think we ought to quit. You may have other questions. Jim, Donald, Paul, myself, and Bob Vedano, and quiz us. We'll be glad to help. Before I close in prayer, just the workshops, what do we got to do on that? Okay, go ahead. And then I'll just close in prayer, okay? Here you are.
Hey, thanks, Jerry. A couple of quick announcements, not only on the workshops. Those who need to get to the airport tomorrow, we need to have an idea when your flight is, and it's firmly. And we will determine when you'll be picked up. You don't get a lot of choice about that, but tell us the time that your flight leaves, and then the staff will be arranging the rides and the transportation back, and that's quite a complicated thing. So we need to know that by 1 o'clock. Adam? Yeah. We need to know it by 1 o'clock today. There is a sign-up sheet outside here, so that airport transportation is very important. On the seminars, Alan Andrews on When Suffering Invades Your Life will be in Castle 303. Bill Moritz, Living and Given, will be in Castle 202. Jim Peterson will be right here about the myths about evangelism in America. And A Heart for Friends, Barbara Tompkins, will be in the Bighorn lower level. One other seminar that we have today is a special one from Tom McGee. And Tom has arrived. And Tom, you might stand. He's going to be doing a 3:30 seminar here in the Great Hall on setting your life, ministry, and business free in Christ. He's the National Director for Church Ministries of Freedom in Christ Ministries. Dallas Seminary grad. He's an Aggie. That may attract a few people.
Can you be both?
Yeah, you can. I've vacationed the last 2 years with some Aggies, so I know the difficulties that are present with that. That's it, Jerry.
Okay. 3:30. Let's stand and we'll close in prayer. Father, thank you for instructing us by our experience, but especially from your word. God, help us to be stewards of what you have given us so graciously in these many years, and give us wisdom to develop these leaders that you've put in our laps around the world, next door to everywhere. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.